From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Islamic State militants are said to have shot down a Jordanian warplane. A suicide bomber kills a number of people near Baghdad. The U.S. president welcomes a decision by Sony Pictures to release a movie about the leader of North Korea. And talks begin in the Ukraine crisis. It's all ahead. I'm Dave DeForest. A Jordanian plane participating in the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State group was shot down south of the IS-controlled town of Raqqa today. The pilot was captured by the group. Edward Uranian reports.
صرح مصدر مسؤول في القيادة العامة للقوات المسلحة الأردنية الجيش العربي بما يلي.
Jordanian State TV read a statement by military officials announcing the downing of a Royal Jordanian Air Force jet and the capture of its pilot by Islamic State militants in the north of Syria. The statement noted that the group and those who support it would be held responsible for the pilot's safety. Jordan, Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are participating in the U.S.-led coalition in air operations against Islamic State. Qatar is reportedly participating logistically, but not flying air missions. Jordan's information minister, Mohammed Mohmani, told Al Arabiya TV that a missile fired from the ground caused the plane to go down. He added that efforts to rescue the pilot were unsuccessful. He stressed that he hoped intelligence work would succeed in gaining the pilot's release. The Islamic State group released photos of the captured pilot being held by over a half dozen militants, some wearing ski masks. One photo showed the pilot, identified as 26-year-old Ma'az al-Kasasbi, being carried by the shoulders in his wet underwear. Arab TV channels say that Kasasbi was pulled out of the Euphrates River after ejecting. The Jordanian fighter jet was the first coalition plane to be shot down by Islamic State militants. The militants have shot down Syrian government warplanes and helicopters in the past, in addition to Iraqi government helicopters. Reports first surfaced in 2012 that Syrian militants had acquired heat-seeking missiles known as MANPADs from Libya. It is not clear if the Islamic State has been able to procure other types of surface-to-air missiles from other sources. James Denslow of the London-based Foreign Policy Center tells VOA that it will be difficult to determine exactly where the missile came from or who sold it to whom unless video footage appears of the missile being fired.
This point as to who's arming who in that region is boundless. I guess the only point in which this becomes a real issue is if there is footage of the taking down of the aircraft that can then kind of identify the weapon system used, and that can then narrow down those who have it, those who've possibly sold it. Again, it's difficult, though, because weapons that have been transferred or sold or given to one group may have been captured by another. So it's very murky, and I think it's impossible to say at this point.
Denslow points out that the fate of journalists and aid workers taken captive by Islamic State has often been pretty grim, so the fate of an actual bona fide combatant could likely be even worse. ISIL has ripped up the rulebook and is writing it itself, he adds, so I think it would be unlikely they adhere to rules that they don't believe in. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Iraqi officials say a suicide bomber targeting pro-government Sunni militiamen has killed a number of people in an attack near the country's capital. The blast happened today in the town of Madain, about 45 kilometers south of Baghdad. Representatives of Ukraine, Russia, pro-Russian rebels, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe resumed talks today on a possible settlement of the Ukrainian crisis. The negotiations are focusing on how to solidify a September ceasefire and to encourage the pullback of troops and heavy weapons, prisoner exchanges, and the delivery of humanitarian aid to eastern Ukraine. Speaking at a cabinet meeting Wednesday, Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk called upon the pro-Russian separatists to live up to the Minsk protocols. U.S. President Barack Obama is welcoming Sony Pictures' decision to release a controversial movie about the assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Sony pulled the interview last week after its computers were hacked by unknown attackers who threatened more damage if the film was released as scheduled. The U.S. blamed North Korea for the cyber attack. As Sony Pictures reversed course and prepared to release that film, North Korea's internet service remained spotty after going completely dark for nearly 10 hours on Monday. The movie is a comedy about an assassination plot against North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It drew sharp criticism from the North Korean government, although it has denied any involvement in the Sony hacking. Although the U.S. government has refused to discuss its involvement in any, if any, in North Korea's internet outage, Matthew Prince, the CEO of the California-based internet security firm Cloudflare, told VOA's Victor Beatty there are three possibilities.
The first, which can seem somewhat absurd to people living somewhere like the United States, is that the North Koreans themselves may be taking themselves off the internet. That seems absurd, but we've seen other authoritarian regimes such as Syria, Egypt, Libya just in the last year do exactly that. And so often in times of turmoil in countries, they'll try and isolate themselves more from outside influence. And so the first possibility could be that North Korea has intentionally taken themselves off the internet in order to isolate themselves from any outside influence. The second possibility is that this could be just an extremely ill-timed hardware failure. North Korea is connected to the rest of the internet over a single connection. If they're not the least connected internet country in the world, they're certainly in the top five. Third possibility, which is the one that a lot of people are speculating about, is that there may have been some outside influence, some sort of an attack, which actually saturated the North Korean pipes and made it so that they weren't available online. And all of North Korea's capacity for their internet connection amounts to essentially 500 home broadband connections. So it wouldn't take a lot to overwhelm those connections with a bunch of illegitimate traffic, effectively crowding out any of the legitimate North Korean traffic.
I wanted to ask you about some of these groups like Guardians of Peace, which purportedly claimed responsibility for going after Sony Pictures computer networks, and groups like Anonymous. Do these groups make it more difficult, and is there a growing threat to cybersecurity as a result of the existence of these groups?
One of the real challenges online today is that a single individual with a laptop can cause an enormous amount of harm. So there was just 2 weeks ago a British teenager that was convicted of launching what's known as a denial of service attack, which is basically flooding a connection with so many requests that it crowds out all the legitimate requests. The attack that this teenager launched 2 years ago was over 300 gigabits per second of traffic. That's two orders of magnitude more traffic than the entire capacity of the North Korean internet. And this teenager was able to do it from a single laptop working on his own. If an individual or a small group of individuals can anonymously launch these attacks, then that poses a real challenge. And part of what Cloudflare is built to do, and services like Cloudflare, is to make sure that anyone who is a bully can't shut down some speech or some other part of the network that they potentially disagree with. And so, you know, whether it's the Guardians of Peace, you know, whoever that is, if that's North Korean hackers or someone just trying to masquerade as North Korea, or Anonymous, which is a very loose-knit group of individuals that from time to time come together in a collective cause. The real risk here is that you have this asymmetry where a small group of individuals can negatively impact even some of the largest companies and even, you know, in some cases, nation states by using cyber attacks to target them.
Prince says the internet is a network operated from the bottom up, not the top down, and is governed by all of its participants. Any global effort to enforce certain standards would raise the risk of some countries gaining enough influence to censor parts of the web they don't agree with. Sean Gallagher, IT editor of the technology and science website Ars Technica, says Sony Pictures was woefully unprepared to deflect November's cyber attack.
Sony didn't take this sort of an attack as a serious possibility in its planning for security. And the way that these people managed to work their way into Sony's network and get into sensitive data is something that's happened on a number of occasions this year and over the last year. For the past several years, it's become a more and more regular sort of event. The hacking of Target and of Home Depot, for example, which was strictly cyber criminal activity, where they went in and stole credit card numbers from point-of-sale systems, it used a similar sort of technique. They used a stolen password, stolen credentials for someone who had access to the network to gain access and go in and plant malware. And in that case, it was malware that allowed them to skim credit card information off of registers. In this case, they used a stolen administrative password to get into the system and get access to servers in Sony's network, and then were able to distribute malware across all the computers in the network. It wasn't something that required a great deal of magical programming skill. It is something that required a great deal of time and effort, and someone took a very long time to go through their network and collect information about how it worked and used that, along with the administrative access they had gained, to deal a very crippling blow to the network.
Is this a growing issue?
It is, and the problem is that this sort of an attack is within the grasp of more and more types of organizations. Criminal organizations are willing to hire themselves out to just about anyone for a dime. People have developed the technology to do these things. What used to be considered a state-sponsored sort of capability, this advanced persistent threat, is something that's now within the grasp of just about anyone who has the time and the determination to learn how to do it. And in the case of North Korea, it's believed that they've basically leveraged a lot of information available in underground marketplaces on the internet to learn how to do this sort of malware. And they've been perfecting their attack over time. They've used tools that the Iranians have also used. I think we'll be seeing more of these attacks, especially since it gained such attention for these attackers and it had a material effect on the target, and it's caused a response from the United States government.
Gallagher says companies like Sony need to use the kind of security measures employed by financial companies to protect their data. He says it is clear Sony stored sensitive employee and partner information in a way that could be easily accessed by outsiders. Well, thank you for joining us for International Edition today on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington, sitting in again for Susan Yaki.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
The International Criminal Court was created to pursue some of the world's worst crimes in places that sometimes are unable to deliver justice. No perpetrator is too powerful to face charges at the Hague-based tribunal, at least that's the idea. But the collapse of the case against Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, and other setbacks are fueling a debate about the ICC's effectiveness and relevancy. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports.
The appeals chamber, by majority, Chad Song partly dissenting.
A victory for the International Criminal Court. Earlier this month, appeals judges at the Hague Tribunal upheld the conviction of Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga. The sentence closed the tribunal's first ever case, and it brings to three the number of cases the court has concluded since becoming operational in 2002, including one acquittal.
There has been no indication from the representative of the government of Kenya that they intend to adopt any of the measures.
But December is better remembered for the collapse of the prosecution's case against Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. The ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, filed a statement withdrawing allegations against him related to post-election violence in Kenya. She blamed Kenyan authorities of intimidating witnesses and failing to deliver documents the prosecution claims were key in building its case. Today, the Kenyatta case is strengthening debate around a fundamental question: should the ICC continue to exist? For Anthony Dworkin, a rights specialist at the European Council on Foreign Relations, the answer is yes.
Well, I believe in the principle of accountability for these terrible crimes. And I think if the International Criminal Court was to be eliminated now, that would be a devastating blow for the whole ideal of international justice. So I really would oppose any move to eliminate the ICC.
Many disagree. Critics argue the ICC is influenced not just by justice, but by politics. The United Nations Security Council refers investigations to the ICC, but three of its members, Russia, China, and the United States, are not member states. Critics say its accomplishments, just two convictions in a dozen years, do not justify the hefty costs of running it. And some African leaders claim the court is biased since all those now on trial are African. Steve Lemoine is senior advisor for the Coalition for the ICC, an international umbrella group. He lists a number of court successes this year, including getting charges confirmed against former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo, whose trial begins next year. He says the court needs the resources and support to do its job effectively, including from its African critics.
The majority of the referrals from these situations in Africa have come from Africa, beyond the referrals by the Security Council and others. As long as there's evidence indicating that they should pursue those cases, I think they should basically do that.
In the Kenyatta case, analyst Dworkin says the prosecution stretched too far.
To pursue a case against an African head of state without the evidence to sustain the case is really a very unfortunate position to be in, even if it simply relates to the fact that it's hard for the court to build a case against a head of state and a government that's not cooperating, and it's going to be impossible for them to do that without stronger international support.
But this month, the court stepped back when it felt it was not getting that international backing. Chief Prosecutor Bensouda told the UN Security Council she had suspended an investigation into alleged war crimes in Darfur for lack of support from the body. Observers say that is unlikely, since Security Council member China has traditionally supported Sudan. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who has an ICC arrest warrant against him for genocide and other charges, claims victory. ICC coalition advisor Steve Lemoine.
The UN Security Council itself seems to be uncommitted and has not taken any action where the government of Sudan itself has failed to cooperate with ICC arresting Omar al-Bashir. So the Security Council needs to take more concrete action in cases where its member states fail to abide by its own resolutions.
In other cases, the tribunal is reaching out. Beyond Africa, current investigations include cases in Colombia, Georgia, Honduras, Iraq, and Ukraine. In Afghanistan, Bensouda says she's looking into the U.S. military's alleged use of so-called enhanced investigation tactics, or torture. Washington is not a signatory of the Rome Statute that established the court, but Afghanistan is. Analyst Dworkin says the Afghanistan example underscores the ICC's fundamental dilemma.
The more it goes after cases which are politically difficult, which are involving major powers like the United States, the less likely it is to achieve results, the more likely it is to provoke hostility among the big powers. On the other hand, I don't think it's a viable way forward for the court to look like it's simply justice for the weak countries of the world.
The solution, Dworkin says, is not to abolish the court, but to strengthen its ability to do its job properly and to be more realistic about what it can achieve and what it cannot. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Wildlife conservationists in Kenya are scrambling to save a rare species of rhinoceros that has been hunted and poached to the brink of extinction. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
The northern white rhino that once roamed a territory stretching from Uganda through the Democratic Republic of Congo and as far north as Chad could disappear within our lifetimes. The Old Pajeta Conservancy in central Kenya is home to three of these animals. Under the watch of armed guards, they meander easily across a natural expanse of grass and shrubs and rub and play and eat with groups of southern white rhinos, their close genetic cousins. Mohamed Doyo has been caretaker to these animals since they arrived at the conservatory in 2009.
The one I'm touching here, she is called Najin, or you can call her Nai. Nai is 25 years old. Her daughter, she is 13 years old, and she is the last one born in the zoo. The other one is Sudan, the only male left in the world.
The rhinos came to Kenya from a zoo in the Czech Republic with the hope that the species would thrive in a more natural habitat. But that optimism has not been met with breeding success, and the population is dwindling fast. One of the rhinos here, Suni, unexpectedly died in October. A zoo in the U.S. city of San Diego lost another in mid-December. San Diego still has one left, as does the zoo in the Czech Republic. But the last wild population in the Democratic Republic of Congo was hunted and killed during armed conflicts in the last decade. Killings of all types of rhinos across Africa have been driven by Asian demand due to the mistaken belief that the horns have medicinal properties. Doyo files down the rhino's horns at Old Pajeta to make them less enticing to poachers. He also had a chance to lobby on behalf of the rhinos to a visiting Chinese basketball legend.
There was a guy here by the name Yao Ming. He was doing a documentary telling the China people should stop believing the horn of a rhino as a medicine. Instead of that, I told him they should use their fingernails or hair because it's one material.
Sudan, the last male of the species, is 41 years old, and his past attempts at mating were unsuccessful. So now conservationists will try to artificially impregnate a young, fertile female. If that does not work, they will try in vitro fertilization, possibly using a southern white rhino as a kind of surrogate mother. The last solution would be crossbreeding between the two species, which are physically and genetically similar. This is Richard Vine, CEO of Old Pajeta.
It's about preserving those genetic traits which confer upon the northern white as a species or a subspecies, whatever you want to call it, the ability to live in Central Africa with all of the disease and habitat challenges that that presents. Those genetic traits could be preserved as part of a hybrid with a southern white. But as long as they're there, then one day, hopefully, maybe in 100 years' time, we'll be able to reintroduce rhinos into that part of Africa.
The fact of the matter is the northern white rhino gene pool has been depleted to the point that preserving the animal as a unique species is quite a long shot. But Vine says this effort is not just about saving one type of rhino.
We're keen to make the point that, you know, if human beings continue to treat the planet in the way that they're treating it, this isn't going to be the only major mammalian species which goes extinct in the next few years. That's going to happen more and more and more.
Vine says the process is expected to get underway in January with the assistance of experts from the Czech zoo where they came from. The good news is that southern white rhino populations have rebounded in the last century since being pushed to the brink of extinction themselves. If crossbreeding is successful, then there is hope that some trace of the otherwise doomed northern white species may still live on. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Kenya.
The U.S. Labor Department says the number of layoffs has declined across the U.S. The number of people signing up for unemployment assistance dropped by 9,000 last week to a nationwide total of 280,000. Economists use initial jobless claims as a way to keep track of the number of people losing jobs. Many experts say jobless claims at this level are a sign of an improving job market as employers hang on to existing employees and begin hiring new ones. Well, that's it for this edition of International Edition on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. By the way, you can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website. Check it out. It's voanews.com. Sitting in for Susan Yockey today, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day.